podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
This is the Ridiculous Ashes podcast. I'm Dan Lipke, and with me is Alex Bowden.
Hello!
We are covering historical Ashes series to find out which nation is more ridiculous at cricket. Is it England or is it Australia? And the new series we're about to cover is the 1981 Ashes.
Yes. As we're starting a new series, for the benefit of new listeners, the format is that each episode we go through a test match, highlighting the various ridiculous moments delivered by each side. We then put them in order, giving the most ridiculous moment 3 points, the second most ridiculous moment 2 points, and the third most ridiculous 1 point. And whichever team gets most points wins that ridiculous test match, although quite often it's a draw. If you're wondering about our definition of ridiculous, we work to the principle, you know it when you see it. It can be really good, really bad, or just really unusual. I nominate England's ridiculous moments. Dan nominates Australia's. Should we just crack on? Should we get a bit of backdrop to the series first?
Yeah, I think so, because before we start a series, we kind of like to feel out where the teams were heading into the series, ridiculous cricket-wise. And this one's a little bit more difficult than some of our previous series. We're going a lot further back. I think our oldest one previously was probably the 1997 Ashes. I don't think we've gone back any further than that.
Yeah, that's the oldest one.
Yes, and now we're jumping 16 years prior to that, which makes me about 10 years old when this series took place. And I don't really have any personal memories of this series. I know the mythos of it, but I don't actually have any recollection of ever having seen it as it happened.
Yeah, I was barely three, so even less. Like, some of the characters are familiar to me.
Yeah.
Well, obviously, they're just kind of like become timeless characters, but also I was like a dim awareness of them during my childhood as being... It was an era when, like, people knew who cricketers were in England, so everyone knew Ian Botham and
yes.
David Gower and things like that when you were four and five.
Yeah.
But, I didn't know why I knew them, I just knew them.
Yeah, and I guess the other problem I had as a 10-year-old Australian was that I'm not sure that during the winter, which was when this was for me, I don't think I paid any attention. I don't think I knew cricket existed in the winter. I'm not sure I had any inkling that this series was taking place. So if it was being broadcast, it was not being broadcast on the TV in my house. So nevertheless, we will crack on and do our best. And I'll just give you a bit of an update on where Australia were going into this series. So this was the first Ashes series since the infamous World Series cricket, which saw most of the players on both sides, to be fair, sucked away by the wicked Kerry Packer. But now they were all back. The previous Ashes series in 1978-79 had seen both sides play without their World Series cricket stars, and England had retained the urn 5-1, which really showed up that 2010-11 side celebrating so hard for a mere 3-1 win. I mean, 5-1's a proper Ashes win.
Yeah.
Anyway, both sides had all their players back now, particularly Australia. Australia had all their big-name players back, except for Greg Chappell, who was kind of in the stage of his career where every now and then he'd just give a tour a miss. He'd say, I can't be bothered touring. Quite happy at home, thanks. So he was giving this one a miss. Kim Hughes returned as captain to the side. It's not incredibly easy to gauge the ridiculousness level of this side, but it was pretty much like the peak macho bullshit era of Australian cricket. So there were also simmering tensions between senior players such as Marsh and Lilly against Kim Hughes. So there's lots of potential for nonsense going on there. So yeah, I think it's a potentially very strong, ridiculous side.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing you still like read, like new, or I like see like news stories in Australian newspapers online even today. So, but I've no real sense of it like playing out at the time, obviously, because I was so tiny. So I'm quite excited to sort of see some of that, or some of the finer detail maybe during this series.
Yeah.
For England, the focus was not for the first or last time largely on Ian Botham, who was captain at this point, and after 10 tests in charge, he'd managed 7 draws and 3 defeats, and I think he'd been saved by the weather in a couple of those as well. It's worth pointing out that nine of those matches were against the West Indies and the other was the centenary test against Australia. So it wasn't an easy run by any means, but still, he wasn't really achieving a lot. And one of his biggest problems was the form of his best player, Ian Botham, who he became captain with a batting average of 40.48 and a bowling average of 18.52 from 25 test matches.
They're handy numbers.
Yeah, pretty tidy. Yeah. And since then, he'd added one half century and no five-wicket hauls, and it just really been stinking up the place.
Yeah.
Immediately before the Ashes, the two teams had played a one-day international series that Australia won 2-1. And in response to this, Alec Bedser, who was then chairman of selectors, announced that Botham was only definitely England captain for this first test match. We have to decide whether the captaincy affects Botham's play, he said. So that was like a real vote of confidence, like going into an Ashes series. You've got like one, you've definitely got one match. You've definitely got one match, but let's not go mad.
We'll see how it goes.
Anything beyond that. So that was how England went into this game. Should we just see how it played out?
Yeah, so in this one test match that Ian Botham was guaranteed, it was played on a seam-friendly pitch at Nottingham. England were sent into bat after captain Ian Botham stupidly lost the toss, and they managed only 185 runs, with Mike Gatting top-scoring with 52. Terry Alderman was on debut and he took 4 wickets. And in reply, however, Australia didn't even surpass England's 185. They scored just 179 runs. And that could have been a lot worse except but for Alan Border. Border combined with the tail to reduce the gap to a mere 6 runs after Australia had fallen to 89 for 6 at one point. The low scores continued in the third innings. England were bowled out for 125. Alderman took 5 more wickets to give him 9 in total for the first test, which surprisingly wasn't good enough to beat Dennis Lilly to the Player of the Match award. So that meant that Australia needed 132 for victory, and they were pretty much untroubled in this chase. There were a couple of late dismissals to Graham Dilley with the target in sight, which meant the victory margin was only 4 wickets, but I think they were more comfortable winners than the scorecard perhaps suggest.
Yeah, it was a bit of a saunter, wasn't it?
Yeah. So what's your first nomination here?
Yeah, I'll go in first, and I'm going in with England's first innings top scorer, Mike Gatting, who was given out LBW in the first innings, and that's the specific moment that I would like to nominate.
Yep.
Because this was a very confusing dismissal. He was given out LBW to a ball that literally went over the stumps. The ball from Rodney Hogg was short enough that he tried to pull it. And watching the highlights, I thought he just missed it and it had gone straight through to Marsh behind the stumps. But he was given out. And both me and Christopher Martin Jenkins on commentary assumed he must have been caught off the inside edge.
Yes, I thought exactly the same thing.
Yeah. I mean, watching it, that was the only real conclusion you could draw. I mean, it's worth mentioning here that the live footage was from behind the batter. Yes. Because that was how they did things in 1981. Even if, like, they did have loads of the cameras, but whichever end they were bowling from, your vantage point as a viewer was the same. Presumably so you could have that genuine in-ground, not exactly sure what's going on experience, you know, the real true-to-life thing there. They did at least give you a decent seat. It wasn't one camera at square leg or with a restricted view behind a pillar or something like that. And you didn't, you know, you didn't follow the cameraman to the bar or the toilet or anything. or maybe you did, but it didn't make the highlights at the end of the day. Anyway, a replay from a different angle showed that the ball, in fact, hit Gatting's back thigh, which initially makes it feel like a slightly more plausible dismissal, except his leg was exactly vertical. So I'm no physicist, but physics-wise, it's hard to see how the impact would have catapulted the ball upwards and over the stumps, which is where it went.
Yeah.
I watched it multiple times, and it just looked wrong.
Yeah. I'd very much like to get the famous footage of Gatting post-Warne dismissal, you know, raising the eyebrows, shaking his head in bemusement. I'd like to splice that in after this particular decision, because I think that's a fitting spot for it.
Yeah. As a kind of footnote to this nomination, in the second innings, he was LBW again, this time to Terry Alderman. And there's another like TV quirk of the day. The first replay appeared to show him absolutely middling it, but it was just like a frame rate thing. And quite a lot of ball movement happened between that frame and the next one, where it was already sort of cannoning away back towards the bowler. And a replay from another angle showed that the ball just slammed straight into his leg. So, I mean, it is partly the limitations of the coverage, I think, but this one.
Yeah, they're like these flickery old, you know, those old time cameras in, you know, silent movies, just flickering, you know, 12 frames per second or something. Gatting was very unlucky that this test was played a mere 27 years before the invention of DRS. You might have scraped got a few more runs in the first innings.
Probably not many the way the match went, but.
No. No. All right. Well, my first nomination is Australia's two-man bowling attack. So before the match began, there was great concern from the commentators about the lack of spinners. They particularly were, you know, frowning at Australia, who went in with four fast bowlers. And one of those fast bowlers was, as we mentioned earlier, Terry Alderman on Test debut. And the thing that kind of impressed me about this, and I've seen Terry Alderman bowl before. I remember him distinctly in 1989, in contrast to my complete lack of memories in 1981. And it's interesting to see in Australia pitching it up and trying to swing it. You just don't see that anymore. Terry Alderman, I'm tossing this right up there and I'm going to see if I can get some outswing. And he did. Four wickets in the first innings, then five in the second. And pretty much every time Alderman, this is a bit of hindsight corner here, where things are only weird in retrospect.
Yeah, we say those are ineligible, don't we? If it's only ridiculous with the benefit of hindsight, we exclude those from consideration.
They are indeed excluded. But every time Alderman came on to bowl to Gooch, I expected an LBW. Just like, this is going to happen. And it didn't, which was very strange to me. Lily, in fact, got Gooch this time. Alderman finished with 4 for 68 off 24 overs in the first innings, which is impressive because the entire innings was only 56.4 overs.
Yeah, I checked this. He bowled 42% of Australia's overs in the first innings. And then I'm going to spoil your next bit of nomination. But he bowled 50% in the second innings.
Yes. So Australia's second innings was 38 overs long, and he bowled a 19-over spell, basically unbroken at one end. It was mostly just Alderman and Lilly. Alderman was unchanged at one end. Lilly got, Lilly, the total slacker, got a break of 3 overs to allow Rodney Hogg to have a very short spell. And Jeff Lawson just hung around doing nothing in the outfield in the second innings. This was admittedly helped a little bit by bad light and rain delay. But still, it's crazy that Australia basically had two bowlers in their second innings, and it worked. I mean, they took 5 wickets each, so, you know, fair enough. Kim Hughes, not such a crazy fool of a captain.
I mean, just to take Alderman, it is really the two of them, but Alderman, the donkey work out of the two donkeys. He bowled 43 overs in the match, and you'd look at that in isolation and think, oh, that's quite a heavy workload for a match, for a pace bowler. But Australia only bowled 95 overs in total. So it's not like he was called upon because they were just really struggling to get through again, called back again and again and again. He was only brought on to bowl about 3 times in total across the entire match.
Yep.
It's just that no one ever thought to take him off again.
I did enjoy at one point, to my surprise, a graphic popped up on the screen and it showed the over rates. And they were saying over rates 12.34 overs per hour by Australia in the first innings, which is very precise, 12.34. England were 13.95 overs per hour. And I mentioned that just in case you thought that people fretting about over rates was strictly a modern concern. No, people have been moaning about over rates forever. So, yeah.
Yeah, I know. I was struck by that because you do get the sense that it is this modern phenomenon. And obviously, it's you can point to a lot of things that contribute to slow over rates these days, which have slowed the pace of the game. But in these days, there's absolutely no excuse. And 12.34 overs an hour.
Yep. I guess the only excuse is that they had two bowlers bowling, so they probably took longer breaks between the overs. But I guess that should be counteracted by the fact there's no discussion about who's going to bowl next. It's just like, all right, Terry, you're up.
Unless it was discussed regularly and on each occasion, we'll go with Terry Alderman, I think.
Yes, that's another possibility.
Okay, my second nomination is England's catching, largely the first innings. In Australia's first innings, England dropped, I think it was 7 chances, which is quite a lot to put down in what turned out to be a close, low-scoring game.
Yes.
Although, as a measure of how difficult it was, to bat there. Just a reminder, they did bowl Australia out for 179. They bowled Australia out for 179 while shelling seven chances.
So 17 for 179, potentially.
Yeah. So, they were definitely creating chances, even though Beefy was bowling sort of wide long hops and things. Probably the sort of most wince-inducing drop out of the seven was wicketkeeper Paul Downton's of Alan Border, who seemed to have caught it, only then to lose it on his way to a celebratory throw, which is always a pretty terrible way to... it's not 100% clear that's what he's doing, but there's a definite air of the arms are about to go up, yes, in celebration.
Yes, he's about to... Yeah, there's an air of jubilation about him that is quickly undone.
Yeah, I don't know what the odds are that Alan Border said you've just dropped Ian Botham's terrible captaincy.
Yeah.
And Botham himself, as a measure of what a wonderful time he was having, he dropped three, one of which hit him in the chest. He did eventually catch Border off his own bowling, and he almost dropped that one. He sort of flinched first, but then somehow still had time to take the catch.
One of the reasons why it was a very seam friendly pitch from the looks of it, and both teams had multiple slips and gullies. It was either four slips and two gullies or five slips and a gully on several occasions. Like every time you looked up, there were just slips and gullies everywhere. So
there was no divide between the fielding position. It was just this big long line. I was struggling to count a lot of the time. You know, if they edge it down, I'd try and do a quick head count to see how many, but the ball fly past and I could only get up to five.
Yeah.
I think there's someone else.
I think my favourite piece of England slip fielding wasn't any of the catches because I kept dropping those. My favourite piece was at one point, Alderman, this is the last wicket partnership, Alderman and Border are batting together, and Alderman's on strike and he drops it at his feet, and Border calls him through for this kind of frantic single. And just as an aside, the commentary at that point was he was off like a little ferret, which tickled me quite a lot.
I think it was Tom Graveney. It's hard not to spot that because it's such a it's commentary from a different era, wasn't it? I can't imagine Nasser Hussain referring to ferrets. Ferrets have really lost their profile in popular culture in the last few decades.
They have. It's very sad. But it was very descriptive. Border off like a little ferret to try and pinch the strike, and Botham is also charging through. He's got the idea that he'll run alongside Border and try to run him out by kicking the ball onto the stumps. But instead, again, in an example of how terrible Botham's form is in all manner of sporting endeavours, his kick is wild. It comes kind of off the outside of his shoe, and Gooch has to run over from first slip and dive to prevent what I can only assume would have been gone down as four overkicks. It was a wild effort from Botham, but good fielding from Gooch.
Yeah, that was England's peak fielding, wasn't it? The Gooch dive.
Yes. And I guess the other thing about this one was that England weren't taking any catches, so the fans and the viewers weren't given the opportunity to see England take catches, which meant, apparently, according to the broadcaster, we didn't get a chance to see Australia take catches either, because there are at least a couple of catches where the cameramen just didn't bother getting them on their cameras. Yallop took a catch off Gooch that was described as a great catch, and not a single camera was able to capture it. The first cameraman was following the path of the slice ball to the boundary, and the replay cameraman just didn't seem to have anything in frame. So that was nice.
Yeah, just doing the sort of panning around madly, just like... So again, it was the real coverage from the stands thing, where you just, I don't know where the ball is, and then someone's traipsing off the field. I guess it was a catch.
Yep.
The broadcaster just felt the catch was best left unseen.
Yes.
Right, I think, I was going to say that wraps up my nomination, but was it your nomination? You seem to have quite a lot to say.
Yeah, I did enjoy the drop catches. They were very entertaining.
What's your next one?
My next nomination is Terry Alderman's helmet. So we had Terry Alderman before. We've got him again here. So I could have nominated a few of the Australians for their helmets. John Dyson and Jeff Lawson both had similar helmets. But Alderman's was the one that caught the eye. So helmets were relatively new. I'm not quite sure how long they've been around. I know that Tony Gregg famously came out in a motorcycle helmet during World Series cricket, but this was... this was a little bit after that, and there's been a slight evolution in the helmets. But most of the England batters Couldn't be bothered wearing them. There were a few wearing them, but most of them couldn't be bothered. And quite a few of the Australians couldn't be bothered with helmets either. Newfangled mamby-pamby nonsense, presumably. But Terry Alderman, who was always a dreadful batter, came out and he had quite a startling piece of headwear. So he's got this standard white lid, no Cricket Australia or Australia Cricket Board branding as yet, of course. And the lid covers, the top half of his head is covered by the helmet, nothing unusual about that. But instead of the grill that we're used to these days, he had this kind of solid, transparent, I want to say Perspex facial protector covering the bottom of his nose all the way down to his chin, and it just jutted out in front of his face, and it was just this enormous, solid block of what looked like plastic. I don't know what the transparent material was, but I'm not at all convinced it would have protected his face if it had been struck. It might have slowed the ball down 10% as it shattered, but that would have been it, I think.
I'm just seeing it in my mind's eye now, and it's just a case of, it reminds me a bit of like a police riot helmet.
Yes.
Maybe not like the front of it. But this has also just reminded me that quite often I've seen loads of in footage of Indian police at demonstrations, quite often they will be wearing cricket helmets.
Right.
Genuinely, I don't know if there's like where that helmet comes to hand, but I've seen it multiple times. Someone sent it to me once. It seems to be like a trend that sometimes use a cricket helmet for policing a riot.
Okay. Maybe they had to because Terry Alderman had stolen all their helmets to use while batting in the cricket, so fair enough. I mean, I wasn't sure at first whether I'd nominate the helmet, but I did discover that ridiculous is an anagram of curious lid, and at that point I felt I had no choice but to nominate these helmets.
That's the clincher, isn't it?
It is.
It was Jeff Lawson's helmet that struck me more, I think, because the non-grill grill was so large. It was that sort of, like I say, a bit riot-y, a bit welder's mask sort of look to it.
Yes,
I would assume that those helmets date this match really quite precisely, that there was quite a narrow window during which they were used. And if you were a real student of cricket headgear, you could say, oh yeah, that was June 1981.
Oh, I mean, that's a game that somebody should play. Get a half a dozen helmets from throughout the years and challenge somebody to put them in the right order of headwear protection.
Okay, my final nomination is Bob Woolmer's recall. England had been having number three problems. not for the last time. But over the previous eight innings, Brian Rose, Mike Gatting and Bill Athey had recorded scores of 10, 5, 2, none, 2, 1, 3 and 1. So England recalled Bob Woolmer.
Number three problems always feel like, it just feels like a strange concept to me. I can understand having a problem with openers constantly struggling with the new ball because, none of them can handle movement or whatever. And I can understand individual batters being out of form, and I can understand having a problem, down the order when, all your bowlers are rubbish, so you've got nobody to put in at number eight or something. But it seems very strange to have a number three problem that's not inextricably tied to the openers always getting out early. It seems very odd. Always strikes me as very odd.
Yeah, maybe displacement of incompetence, or just, I don't know, who's the focal point, isn't
it?
You only need one opener to fail for number three to be exposed, I suppose, if they take it in turns.
Yeah, I guess.
Number three can, fail every single match and have a tough time. I don't know, but it does seem to be, a particular, it often been a thing for England.
Yeah.
Not, easy conditions to bat at the top of the order, but it's, I don't know, I've had plenty of opening problems as well, I suppose.
Yeah, that's true. But,
anyway, England had recalled Bob Woolmer, batting saviour, because he'd previously been dropped for slow scoring, but they decided, okay, speed of scoring is the least of our worries here, let's bring back Bob, and then at least we'll get some runs out of our number three. Woolmer promptly recorded a nine-ball duck in the first innings, before really picking up the pace a bit in the second innings with a four-ball duck, so that was an absolute triumph.
Yes, good work, Woolmer. So 13 deliveries faced. It was only out to, 2/13 of them, so that's not bad.
And Australia weren't dropping any catches, so he didn't give any more chances, I don't think.
Bloody Aussies. Yeah. All right, so my final nomination is Dennis Lilly's futile boundary footwork. So this was just a specific moment that caught my eye. So this is during England's second innings, and David Gower whips one off his pads. It's all very elegant, as we'd expect from David Gower. But Lilly's racing around in the outfield, and he eventually gets to the ball, and he just stops it with his foot just inside the rope. And he seems pretty pleased with himself after this effort. He's you know, put the big ones in, and he's just got there in time. And it's a low-scoring match. You know, every run could be crucial, and there've been plenty of moments during the match where outfielders, you know, they didn't actually put a lot of effort in those days. So, you know, Dilly had attempted similar footwork earlier in the match, and the ball had just rolled straight over the top of his foot for four. So Lilly was feeling pretty pleased with himself, and he kind of, yeah, I've stopped this boundary, and he slows down gradually and, you know, pretty chuffed with himself. And then at some point he looks up and realizes that Gower is running very hard between the wickets, and in fact is about to run a fourth run. So Lilly sprints back to the ball and hurls it in, but he can't prevent the all run four. And yeah, so a good effort from Dennis Lilly, which he pretty much completely undone by being so impressed with how well he'd done.
Yeah, I swear you don't see anywhere near as many all run fours anymore, even on like big Australian grounds. And I don't know if it is this sort of sense of urgency where, like, they thought he'd done the job and just kind of cantered around to return it. And the other thing I'd sort of highlight in that is there was a classic Gower moment. I think it's in the first innings, where just after he'd come in, where no one's really scoring any runs, and he hit one shot, and it was the classic sort of effortless Gower drive where I thought he'd just kind of blocked it. You know, the ball just like raced away. There's no real movement, and yet the ball just like careered away across the outfield for four runs, and it was very hard to comprehend. And this is often why Gower was sort of characterized as being someone who didn't make much effort, because it didn't look like he did.
Yeah.
But then an all run four is unarguably like a pretty high effort way of scoring your runs.
Yes. I mean, similar to Gower's trademark, yeah, effortless shots. There was also a moment in Australia's innings when Border was batting, and there was a ball outside of stump, and he cut it for four, then took a couple of steps down the pitch and just banged an imaginary spot in the pitch three times with his bat, and, you know, snarled his way back to his crease. And I swear to God, I saw that 1,000 times watching Alan Border as I was growing up. It was the most familiar sight I saw in the entire test, was Border cutting a shot for the boundary, then smacking the shit out of the pitch.
I like those moments where you don't even realise what a deeply embedded memory it is until you see it again sort of out of context. Because at the time, it's just like a mundane thing, and you're like, oh my God, I forgot this was such a big part of my life, watching Alan Border jab at the turf with his bat.
All right, do we have any unnominated moments?
Yeah, this is the bit of the episode where we just like, we've got our leftovers and we don't want to waste them.
Yeah.
A few things I want to highlight. One, this was the first Sunday of Test cricket in England, I think. They'd always previously had a rest day.
Wow. God must have been furious.
Yes. I mean, you're lucky if you get a rest day between Tests these days, let alone during the match. It's a real mark of the times.
Yes. I particularly enjoyed just the general existence of Trevor Chappell, who played in this test. I always forget that Trevor did anything other than bowl the underarm ball. But he was playing in this test. At one point, I didn't pay much attention to the team names as they came on, and I saw the commentators say Chappell, and I thought, oh, good, Greg's here. And then, nope, that was Trevor. So he was out there. Greg was lazing about at home somewhere. And, I also quite enjoyed that. The only time in the fourth innings run chase where Australia were perhaps in a teensy bit of potential trouble, they were 80 for four, chasing 132, and it might have been a little nervy at that point, except for the fact that it was, you know, Border and Chappell batting together, and that kind of made me feel, all right, that's okay. Even if it is only Trevor, Border and Chappell, I think we're going to be fine here.
And so it proved.
It so proved, yes.
The end of the climax of the match, you used to sort of seeing teams celebrate when they win a match. The climax of this one was so like big and overblown that I actually spent quite a while scouring the internet for day five highlights before. Like, it was such a fruitless search. I went back and checked, like, oh no, the match had finished. I just hadn't registered that Australia had won. I thought it was still like a few runs to go.
Yes. And I guess the only other highlight that I've got here that wasn't nominated, because I'm not really sure which team gets it, was everybody was very desperate for the possibility of Lily caught Willy Bold Dilly. And we didn't get that. We got Lily caught Downton Bold Dilly, which is, you know, no good at all. Despite having two out of the three in there, it's still no good. No. You've got to have all three.
It's the ghost of what's missing, isn't it? It's hard not to look out for. I swear Graham Dilly was brought back onto ball the minute Dennis Lilly walked out to bat. That is the absolute first thing that happened.
Yes.
Right, let's get into the votes then.
Yes.
What's your top nomination?
I think my favourite nomination of my three is probably Lily's footwork. I did quite enjoy just how pleased, like he was noticeably pleased with himself for stopping the four, and then the kind of look on his face when he realised, oh shit, I haven't stopped a four at all. He's going to run back the bugger. So yeah, that tickled me quite a lot. So that's probably my strongest one.
Essentially, he's showing such satisfaction for changing the nature of four.
Yes.
Put a few miles into England batter's legs.
Yeah.
I think my top nomination was England's catching, which was just so woeful. Just catch after catch going down. When you know, you've got nothing, there's no runs to play with. Just dropping everything is not what you want to do.
You've packed the slips corner. They're all there specifically to catch cricket balls. They're not cutting off runs. They are there to catch cricket balls, and none of them could do it. It was ridiculously, very, very ridiculously bad. It's very amusing. So I do think that's probably our three-point getter, because I don't think any of mine can trump just how terrible England's catching was in this test.
I mean, it obviously wasn't like ground conditions or anything either, because Australia weren't dropping anything. It was England fielding, just purely England fielding.
Yeah,
mostly Ian Botham.
The rest of them, I mean, this was perhaps a vote in favour of Botham's leadership. He was leading the way in the drop catches, and everybody said, all right, we'll follow this man. I think that was the only thing in his favour, captaincy.
Of my other nominations, I think, as I say, the Woolmer, the pair-notching batting saviour, is... I think it's just such a perfect moment. To bring somebody back to shore up the top order, like knowing what you're getting, like accepting the limitations, thinking, well, no, because we definitely, we just need a few runs. That's all we need, and that's what we're going to get. And then to get zero runs across both innings, I think it's very sort of a comprehensive performance to deliver exactly nothing.
Yes, I think that was very good. I also enjoy, from my side, the two-man bowling attack, which was very silly, particularly Alderman's place in it, bowling, you know, basically half the overs in the entire test.
Like a quarter of the match.
Yeah, like I'm
thinking he's morally or something. I don't know. I struggle to split those two, actually. If we're going for England's catching as first.
Yes. I think Lily's footwork gets 2 points. And I think that the silliness of Woolmer being specifically brought in to score runs slowly, but to score runs and then to precisely not do any of that is probably trumps Terry Alderman. I've got a feeling that we're going to see some more Terry Alderman nominations as we go along in this series. So,
I mean, I suppose what you would say in defence of the Woolmer one, or rather sort of like not belittle but minimise the Alderman nomination, is that there was very good reason for keeping Terry Alderman on.
Yeah.
It wasn't like a ridiculous decision. He was bowling out. He was bowling Australia to a win. So that entirely made sense, whereas Woolmer's was just goading the selectors, really. It was excellent.
Yes. All right, so 3 points for England's catching, 2 for Lily's footwork, 1 point for Woolmer. So I think that means England win the first test by 4-2. So England take an early lead in the ridiculous Ashes.
Botham's first and only test victory as a captain.
Yes. Very, very proud he must be. And I think that will wrap us up for the first episode. So thank you for listening. You can check out Alex's website. That's over at kingcricket.co.uk. Mine is at leibcricket.com. You can follow us on Twitter or X or whatever it's now called, or whatever alternative social media platform, you know, arises in between the recording of this and the posting of it. Either way, you can find us at Ridiculous Ashes, at The King's Tweets, at Leib Cricket, or, you know, variations thereof. And we will be back in a week week with our coverage of the second test of the 1981 Ridiculous Ashes. Can Australia bounce back from this first test defeat? If you subscribe to the podcast, you will find out the answer to that question. And while you're doing that, you can give us your honest five-star ratings on the podcast store of your choice. And we will see you all next week.
See you next week.
Sports Social Podcast Network.